The premise Tuesday night was, when the scriptures talk about abundant life and when the scriptures have some image of what real freedom is, I used a word to describe that biblical assumption, and the word was sufficiency. In fact, let me give you the one Bible verse that probably more than other characterized some dozen sections of scripture that we reviewed very briefly. Proverbs 30, 8 and 9. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is needful for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. The assumption Tuesday night was that there is no freedom in poverty, nor is there freedom in having too much. That there is a slavery and a lack of being who we really are meant to be if we have too little or if we have too much. And a biblical idea of the full life is a life that has enough. Another way to say that, and we did this Tuesday night, I am not in any way denying that the promise of God is that God gives to God's children rich, full measure, shaken down. There's an image of a basket, shaken down and overflowing. Not denying that at all. What we're talking about more in these two sessions is how big is the basket? And I think we live in a culture that would tell you, if your basket is full, get a bigger basket. And the premise Tuesday night was, if that's true, and you don't have any idea when you're full or when you have enough, the tendency will be for you to have less gratitude about life because you will always be getting a bigger basket and saying, here's another one to fill, Lord, which robs us of the sense of feast of life, gift of God. Is that enough from Tuesday night, you that were here? All right. We will keep coming back to those roots as we do some practical things, but I think it's important for you to know that there is a thesis, and that is that a biblical understanding of sufficiency is an assumption with which we're going to work tonight. In order to move into the lifestyle part, I'd like to share from an editorial, well, they call it an essay. Once in a while, Time Magazine has an essay. This one was from June 4th, 1979. I don't think I do injustice by reading from four different sections. I think I'm being fair to the author in the ones I picked. Toward dusk, their small boats go whumping across lakes and bays, rooster tailing on fierce twin 100 outboards. Caravans of 8 mile to the gallon RVs start homing off the interstates, their occupants damply chilled in the air conditioning, bathed in Dolly Parton from the tape deck. In shopping malls, supermarkets the size of National Guard armories feel as cold as meat lockers, and housewives in pedal pushers load their carts with food encased in a wealth of non-returnable glass, metal, and paper. They shake their heads as they pay what the checkout computer demands of them and pile the groceries into broad-beamed station wagons. At home, the automatic ice maker sighs and clatters in the kitchen, the automatic washer discos through the spin cycle, and the microwave starts the dinner. Meantime, in winding ropes of bright capillaries, the slow and overpowered commuting cars poof home. From above at night, American cities look like garishly jumbled jewelry strewn up and down the landscape. In the centers, empty high-rises of piled diamonds glow, great sparklers kept alight for the cleaning women, for the admiration of passing planes. For years, foreigners have regarded America, both enviously and contemptuously, as a shocking wastrel. Besotted with its own resources, lighting cigars with $1,000 bills, in winter, visitors remark, the U.S. is always too warm indoors, and in summer it's always too cold. And in a flawless little American parable, Richard Nixon used to turn up the White House air conditioning full blast so he could start a cozy blaze in the fireplace. Since the early 70s, Americans have been flirting reluctantly with a complicated and grudging awareness about themselves and their orgies of fossil burning. But they are still in the quibbling stage in what psychologists call a period of defensive avoidance. This next part, I wish Time Magazine was writing essays like this week. They have quit writing like they wrote in 79. Listen to this. The real calculus of American strength is not expressed primarily in terms of a willingness to fight or in the numbers of missiles and warheads we have. It is not expressed in how tough Americans can be with the Soviets or anybody else abroad. It will be expressed precisely in how tough Americans are willing to be with themselves. A damaging slackness, a widespread feckleness have grown evident not only in American leadership and corporations, but in the U.S. society at large. The tradition of material salvation is the profoundest question confronting Americans. The logic of the energy shortage dictates cut down. Supplies are finite. The questions raised about the nuclear power industry by Three Mile Island accident reinforce that logic. Yet Americans have not sifted through the questions of their priorities. They want energy without risk. They may be a long time in settling the question of what price they're willing to pay for their power. Americans historically have believed that they can have it both ways, indeed have it every way. Their success was erected upon a profligate exuberance. Now the last paragraph, and the heart of the essay. The problem is, I don't know why he doesn't say we. He separates himself from all the rest of us who live in America, but I don't want to clean up his writing because he does say they. The problem is that too many Americans are accustomed to acting only in emergencies, and too few of them are persuaded that they actually face one at the moment. I think that's true. The problem is too many Americans are accustomed to acting only in emergencies, and too few are persuaded that they actually face one at the present moment. Presumably, they will wake up to the certain knowledge of it before too long. As Samuel Johnson said, when a man knows he's to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. Why read that essay? It's because there is an increased awareness of the fact that not everything about our present lifestyle is good for our health. And that we have with defensive avoidance, we have put off the fact that we are not living a lifestyle consistent with an idea of enough or sufficiency, and therefore some major studies, including one authorized by Jimmy Carter when he was president, a group was given a year to do it, and they took 3 years to do it. The editor, by the way, was a fellow Lutheran, if you are Lutheran, a member of our Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Falls Church, Virginia. It was called Global 2000 Report, and it was the fifth of widespread, well-documented reports that tell us we do not now have a lifestyle which is going to mean a sustainable society. Not only not sustainable for the whole world, but that we are in trouble. We have forums at Holden about water shortage in 11 Western states. We do live with the very real possibility of some environmental problems, of some water problems, of certainly some pollution problems, of how do we store the nuclear waste from our nuclear power plants. More and more people are becoming aware that we have to look at our lifestyles. When you look at those lifestyles, you can look at it from any one of a number of ways, just so that you know that when you have 55 minutes, you can do only one of those, and I'm doing only one of those tonight, for instance. We could have looked at those lifestyles solely as a faith issue, and we could have said, Christians do not ask whether it's fun. Christians do not ask whether it's going to be effective, whether it's going to work, whether in the long run we'll be winners. They ask only, is it faithful? And we did a little bit of that Tuesday night, but that's a fundamental question. Last week, especially with Sister Marie Augusta Neal here, when we looked at this issue, we looked primarily from another vantage point, and that is, how big is your family? And that's a very good way to look at our lifestyle question. In other words, the slogan, live simply that others may simply live, is a way in which we say to ourselves that our family includes the whole globe, and some two-thirds of our brothers and sisters are not living today a sustainable life, meaning enough food, medical attention, and decent housing. What happens when we take that approach? Some people get a new consciousness, and Holden takes that approach, and I do it without apology. Sometimes, however, all we really do is get a kind of guilt out of it, and it sounds as though the only thing we should do, it's kind of a mea culpa, oh, what a, and especially Lutherans. I mean, if there's even the slightest invitation into guilt, we jump. Oh, good, another reason for guilt, right? And especially when they show movies of children in other countries who are starving, and we will continue to do that. And statistics. I'll give you one that I think we really do need to keep before us. Our house pets do better than 1 out of 8 brothers and sisters in the world in regard to those 3 things I named: food and nutrition, shelter, and medical care. That's the kind of world we live in, where Fluffy does better than 1 out of 8 human beings who share this globe with us. And that would be a very legitimate way. I'm taking a different one tonight, not because I don't think those first two are important, but because I hear so little of another motivation for lifestyle changes, and that is an invitation to new freedoms. Why is it that when we move into something, one of the first things we do is to feel that we're doing it out of guilt, or to have a new Pharisaism about it? It didn't take 3 weeks for the Simple Life movement to start until we had a simpler than thou attitude. Were you ever with somebody who was simpler than thou? It's just as bad as holier than thou. It really is. So my invitation tonight, with a couple stories and your input of stories, is one of the reasons for changing our lifestyle is it gives us the possibility of some new freedoms. I had a good friend in Washington, D.C. I'm just going to tell you 5 stories, and then quit. I had a good friend in Washington, D.C. When he was 55 years old, he sat down with his wife one night. I knew them well. And he said, "How many of our friends, somewhere when they were between 50 and 60, said to us in one way or another, when we get enough, we're going to retire and do what we've always wanted to do?" His wife's name was Martha, and Martha answered, "I think everyone I know sometime between 50 and 60 has said that." He said, "How many did it that you can remember?" Long pause. She couldn't think of a one. Next question. Why? Obvious answer. You give it. They never... No, there was something before that. No, there was something way before that. They didn't ever sit down to ask what was enough, so they never knew when they were there. And he said, "You know, I don't think that would be so hard." And they did it that night in 3 hours. I'm not judging what for them was enough. What for them is enough is way beyond what I ever need. That's their business. I mean, they build into enough financial security that Mary and I do not need, insurance, transportation to see their 4 kids, and a very nice country home. The point was, not judging what for them was enough, but that night when they sat down and said, "What do we really need for what we say is a full life?" They were within 6 months of it at age 55. And 6 months later, they retired. And they have been doing for some 15 years now the things they really wanted to do. And it is a delight. They got a camp for underprivileged kids in Washington, D.C., with which I participated for a while. Their product to raise money for the camp is Christmas trees. You go out and cut your own, and other people plant some more. It's a marvelous place. He helped get a retreat center that the Lutherans in the metropolitan Washington, D.C. Area participated in, and for a while he puttered and did the carpentry work and did the cooking until it got going. He had always wanted to do that. He wrote his book. All of you have at least one book, and he had time to write that. In other words, instead of retirement being that at the end of life, retirement for them was freedom to do what they had really wanted to do, and it started one night when they determined for themselves what was enough. I'm saying they moved into a new kind of freedom that they would not have had if they didn't ask that question. Let me give you another illustration that's very similar. I have a pastor friend. He happens to be a pastor in the American Lutheran Church, but the story could be just as true in any other denomination. By the way, it was the only place I ever went where we drank goat's milk, and it is not bitter, as the goats have had a disservice done to them. It depends upon what your friends, where the goats had been eating. If the milk was bitter, it's delicious. So you have some idea of the kind of lifestyle they had. They built their own log cabin, they had a goat, and they were serving a congregation where that was okay. They had determined, in regard to what their salary should be, only what they needed, only what was enough, and that's what they asked for in regard to a salary. When they determined what was enough, and they looked at the salaries offered by some 4,000 or 5,000 congregations in the American Lutheran Church, lo and behold, their needs were less than the least salary paid by any congregation in the American Lutheran Church. What did that do? It opened up for them mobility like you cannot believe. They could move anywhere. If you are a pastor or thinking of becoming a pastor, let me tell you that if you need $50,000 a year, your mobility is cut considerably. In the clergy roster, the American Lutheran Church, there are just not many places where you can go. Let me give you a conclusion to their determining what was enough. There was a little parish in a place in the United States where they had always wanted to live. That was one of their dreams. This little parish had been told by the bishops of that district for the last 10 years, you are too small and your budget is too small to ever have a pastor. So they had always had somebody willing to drive out on Sunday morning. They'd never had their own pastor. You know the end of the story. My friend heard of the parish. The parish heard of my friend. And my friend and his wife were going to come to Holden for a year as village pastor. Instead of that, he wrote me the most excited letter you can imagine. They were on their way to this place where they had always wanted to live. The freedom opened up when they determined not what would be deprivation for them, what would be sufficient for them. See if I got a... Oh, yeah, I have a very different kind of story from those two. I've led a lot of retreats. I guess for the last 10 or 12 years, retreats on lifestyle issues. Very seldom have the retreat participants been poor folk. I don't apologize for that. I think I've been with people who are honestly interested in the issue, but there are times when I'm in a little bit of agony on retreats on lifestyle changes being a middle-class luxury. In other words, if we do one of those retreats, I at least want to remind the people on retreat and myself that most people in the world live simply because they have no other choice. And it is a kind of luxury for us to look at options and maybe choose a somewhat simpler lifestyle. But on one retreat, there were some poor folk. Inner city, living on welfare, and one of those ladies, beautiful lady, who was on this retreat, didn't say anything. Friday night, all day Saturday, she just looked. And I didn't know what she was thinking. We went through Enough is Enough by John V. Taylor, went through some stories of lifestyle changes, went through where your values were. Well, Sunday morning, the Eucharist on that retreat lasted 2.5 hours, had a coffee break in the middle of it. And because the shared word that day was sharing from all 24 people who had been on the retreat. They found something, they made something, or they shared something. Well, in the middle of that sharing, she said, I want to tell you what I've been thinking. And I think a lot of people wondered what she had been thinking. She said, I want you all to know that I may be poor, but I ain't stupid. That's a good start. She said, I've been listening. And what I did on this retreat is realize that just before I came on this retreat, I had almost done it again. I had almost bought a kitchen table on time payments. She said, some of you don't know, because some of you don't live in the inner city, and at this time, your carrying charges on MasterCard were about 6%. This was in the 70s, so that it won't shock you to say what she said. She said, the interest I would pay on that dining room table would be 22%. She was right. It's very hard to get interest inner city where in the stores where they have to shop. She said, you know, I realized on the retreat why I was going to buy that dining room table. I had been convinced that I was not a decent mother and a decent human being because my table was shabby. And that's what the retreat has told me, is I don't need a new table to be a decent person and to have God love me and some other people love me. And I hugged her. I'll travel anywhere if I can tell people that you don't need a new kitchen table to be a decent human being. What is the gospel if it's not that your worth has nothing to do with the shape or size or newness of your kitchen table? Do you understand how much we have been sold the idea that our worth is connected with those kinds of things? I'll tell you one other story. This has to do with a group I was with in Washington, D.C. for some years called the Community of Christ. There are several stories linked up together, but they all have to do with the new freedoms of enough is enough, or the new freedoms of efficiency, or sufficiency. One night, the group in Washington, D.C., I hope this doesn't shock anybody, I don't think it will, our religious life was a shared life, weekly, corporate, Eucharist, nightly prayers at 10 o'clock, regular retreats. We enjoyed worshiping together. We also enjoyed partying together. We had some of the best parties. If you can't party with the people you go to church with, something's wrong. If you have a different group to have fun with, look again at what's the matter with your church. All right. We had a great time when we got together. Well, one night was a typical kind of loud and boisterous affair. But one of the members of the Community of Christ stood up and asked for attention. It took longer to get that than it took Tom Witt to get you quiet for announcements after supper, I'll tell you. But finally, settled down. Here was what he wanted. He said, some of you know that Pat and I recently got married. And today, she wanted to shop for a waffle iron, and I said, not until after tonight. So my announcement is this. I would like to know how many in the Community of Christ have waffle irons. Well, I guess there were six hands that went up. And then he went around the room to all six of those. How many times a year do you use your waffle iron? Well, the most was six, and several of them used it once a year. So he went back to one of the ones who had said once a year, and he said, we would like waffles three times a year. Could we borrow your iron? You know the response? Of course you can. And he looked absolutely, he said to his wife, I told you we didn't need to buy a waffle. He said, I think, unless we are waffle freaks, we do not all need waffle irons. And everybody laughed and went on with the party. The next time that same group gathered, somebody said, remember the waffle iron? And everybody laughed. He said, you know, I thought of that today. I went to rent an aluminum extension ladder. Very expensive for a day's rental. So I thought, well, I'll buy one. Well, then I thought, how often do I use one? Clean the leaves out of the gutters once in a while, and once in a while the kids hit a ball up there, but my kids are grown, and paint once every, 7 years? But then I thought, there are four of us within three blocks of one another. If we divided up the cost of the aluminum extension ladder, Heckinger's, this department store in D.C., has a 20-foot expandable aluminum ladder, $32. That's $8 a piece. It would be our ladder, and it would hang in anybody's garage. You use it whenever you want. Sold, just like that. No one said communist plot or it made a lot of sense to share a ladder. Okay, those two incidents, spontaneous, simple, uncomplicated, have meant that group has continued to look at alternatives that mean the simplification of life and more sharing than we normally have. And it's been fun for them to do it. It has meant a food co-op. It's fairly easy to do. It's a voucher system. One person shops. You get a little better quality and choice of large wheels of cheese and other things. You save a little bit of money. If you drive to the places, if you're interested in not so much chemicals in your food, you can buy that way if you want to. In other words, they have found ways in which their lives can be interdependent in a way that's not part of our culture naturally. It's part of rural culture some places still in the United States. We found that in West Virginia. You don't buy a post hole digger. Ernest Pitzenbarger has one. And you all use his when you need it and return it. I mean, it's just part of that culture. They didn't plan that. Well, we had some of that rural mind in the middle of Washington, D.C., 12 blocks from the White House. Two families, one washer dryer. Maybe that's where you would draw the line. Maybe you don't want someone else's dirty underwear in your... Well, then don't do it. For them, it was a step forward, it saved some money, and they enjoyed a cup of coffee together while it discoed through the spin cycle or whatever those things do. So for them, it was a free choice. Just before I left, they had made a move that is really testing the culture in the United States. Three families, one car. That's tougher, right? That's tougher. First of all, it's not as simple as an aluminum ladder because cars are more complicated machines. I'm a little touchy about how my car is driven. I could imagine saying to one of the other three owners, I think you ride our clutch. Or one of your children spilled a milkshake on our front seat and you didn't clean it up very well. That's part of it. Also, most people need a car much more often than you need an aluminum extension ladder, right? Okay, let me tell you a few things they had going for them. First of all, none of the three families needed the car daily to go to work. One of the problems in the United States is we have planned our urban areas around automobiles instead of another form of transportation, and it's one of the problems that is really a difficult one. They didn't have that problem. They lived in walking distance or bus distance from where they were. Secondly, the insurance at that point was phenomenal if you lived in an inner city, so it was costing them much more to have a car than it probably costs you where you live, unless you live in the middle of a city. Thirdly, you cannot imagine, unless you've lived in the middle of a large metropolitan area, what parking problems are. You just will never know. You got some hint if you saw The Odd Couple, when which one was which, Felix and Oscar. Oscar was the sloppy one? Okay, Oscar won a car in some kind of lottery or something. So for the next week, they tried to park it. They lived on a street where up until 4 a.m. you were on one side and then the street washer was... So they'd set the alarm for a quarter of four and they'd stumble down. They finally paid the mafia to blow it up. To give you a little idea of Washington, D.C. compared to New York, when we first moved into Washington, D.C. in the Community of Christ, and I just can't believe I really did this, but I did. I went by and I visited everybody. I didn't have a parish. I had a square mile, and I learned everything I could about the square mile, including the police station. So I walked in. I introduced myself. I didn't tell the man I had no congregation. I just said I was Pastor Schramm, so he assumed I had this large congregation. And I, in essence, said, if there's anything we can do to help. I mean, it was, you know, some of my best friends are preachers, but we really do. Sometimes kind of sound arrogant. And he had an immediate response. He said, look, I don't care if you're religious or irreligious or anything else. The only thing you could really help with is if you have any way to solve the parking problem, I'd be glad to have your help. That was the first thing he said. And he said, we write 8,000 to 10,000 tickets a month, and if I put on 20 more officers, we could write 20 times that number of tickets. And I thought, my gosh, I can't believe that. He was right. We live 10 blocks from the White House. There were no places for people to park. The people who lived there had cars. Then the suburban people that came in to work there, there were 250,000 people in our square mile at noon, and there were only 50,000 who lived there after 5 o'clock. All those people wanted a free parking place or a parking place because the parking lots got filled. It was just incredible parking. One night our neighbor came home. Can you imagine working 8 or 10 hours a day, then coming home and start driving around the block, waiting for a parking place to open when you're tired? Half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour? I mean, you'd see the neighbors, you'd wave to them, they'd go around. One night Charlie, who lived next door, came home and he put his car in the middle of 21st Street, which is a major thoroughfare, got out, went in, mixed himself a good strong martini, put his feet up on the porch, had the martini on his knee, and when the police came, he said, "Take it." So nothing made more sense than cut down the number of cars and yet still have the use of a car when you wanted it. That group now has 4 families, 2 cars. That worked better than 3 families, 1 car. Okay. Do you see the point of what I'm getting at? Not that that's the thing to start with. 3 families, 1 car. The assumption behind it is what I'm saying is transferable wherever you live. That's what I'm saying. Okay, I took about half your time. What kind of lifestyle do you envision if you'd start with what is enough or what is sufficient? What models do you have? Paul Hansen the other night said what we need is some models. Who do you think of in terms of people that you know that are living away that you now realize, by golly, I bet that's why they do that? Or what steps have you taken? Anytime there's a session at Holden, there are people who have started, they never thought of themselves as leading any kind of movement. They've just taken very simple steps, or they've gone back to things that grandma and grandpa used to do that really were very resourceful in the way of some lifestyle things and have realized that that has some integrity to it. What would you like to share for your half of this session on lifestyle based on sufficiency? What have you got?
Don't we like to think of ourselves as probably doing quite well, but we look at someone and we say, well, why do they have to live that well? Why do they have to spend that much on it? One illustration, I had a cousin, Midwest farmer, retired, done well. He came out to visit us and had a beautiful motorhome. We took him to show some of the homes around our town. And he said, it's a crime that they would live in a home like that expensive, spending that much money on themselves. Well, see, that's what I'm talking about.
That you always see the other person doing it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. why can't they cut down, or why can't they do with less and use it for humanity or more?
Mm-hmm.
We see that
instead
of ourselves.
Good point. All right, thank you.
I see some of these people that live in suburbia, and I can talk about this because my son does. He goes to work, his wife goes to work, they have 2 children that go to work. They live out there 5-6 miles from a bus, 4 cars in a family.
Mm-hmm.
And he is just very, very frustrated about the gas bills. But the mistake was moving way out in suburbia, in a piece of land where they wanted to be all by themselves. But to be able to live, they have to work.
So it was a choice, and the choice means some other things that make it less convenient in the way of driving. So we do make choices as to...
They wanted to be out there by themselves. Now people are moving in around them, but they still have to use 4 cars. It's just a vicious circle.
Where do you think the obstacle comes to making lifestyle changes that we really think would be better, but we don't? What is that barrier for people? is convenience enough that stops most of us? That if it's just less convenient, we don't do it? Or here it was a kind of privacy, or a little, not even privacy, but a little space around. People don't like the idea of being downtown in a city. Sharon, what were you going to say?
Sometimes it's like people at some point don't think they really can't trust someone else. And so when they encounter a problem, our first response is, well, how can I solve this?
Yeah.
And if we had better experiences in community with any other kinds of experiences, and really believe that if there's a problem here, probably two or three people can help me solve it better than I can solve it myself.
Okay.
I think convenience is an issue.
Yes.
And I would say just plain economics is an issue. But my neighbor owns a lawnmower, and I don't have money to buy a lawnmower. So I use his lawnmower, I mow my lawn and his.
Uh-huh.
And he's happy and I'm happy.
Uh-huh. Okay. Good example. Yes.
Well, one thing I think that has been, although I think now is beginning to change, is that it used to be more status symbol to live in the suburbs,
yes,
to live out, and you lived in town, that was considered not so terrific. But now it seems like people are tending to do a little more of that preservation, fixing things up, and returning to some of the more in-town kinds of places. But the other thing I was going to say is that I know myself, I have tried to remind myself, I have a nice little car in my garage, and I just automatically go to my car.
Mm-hmm.
And, and I don't stop to think, if I leave a half hour earlier, 15 minutes earlier, I can walk.
Mm-hmm.
Or I have a bicycle, I can ride my bicycle. But you just get so used to doing things the easy way that,
yep,
I just go to my car without thinking I could walk to the store, or I could, do things like that. And I think a lot of it is just that it's been an easy way to do it, and we tend to not get in the habit of doing things a different way.
Okay, two good points. One is status. We really are affected by what people think or find our worth that way. And the reason that I took the biblical assumption Tuesday night is, I think we often, instead of being shaped by what we assume is God's word, we are shaped more by the cultural assumptions around us. And so much of what it means to be part of a Christian congregation is to surround ourselves with other people who share the biblical values rather than the cultural assumptions that really come heavy at us. And then the other is, it's easier, or it's what I've always done, or we don't take the time to think through options. Is Hans here? I see Katie. Doesn't he ride his bike most days?
That's what I was going to share with you. He is riding his bike. It's about 24 or 25 miles round trip.
Yeah.
Most every day. Some days when it's pouring down rain, we've had a lot of rain this summer, he will say, oh, I've got to drive.
Yeah.
And I needed the support of riding a bike with someone else. I couldn't get myself to start off on my own to do this. And so he bought me a bike. And he goes along with me to show me the safest route. And so now I'm starting to commute on my bicycle too.
Great.
And it's really exciting to see the reaction that you get from people. Oh, this is terrific. I wish I could do this.
John, may I say a rod of that as another commuter by bike?
All right.
And I think that does put another value in focus. I think values are one of the things we're talking about. One value is to have the status symbol, to have the big suburban house with the swimming pool and the horse. The other is to have freedom.
Okay.
We have no yard, basically, but I can commute not 28 miles round trip, but 8 miles to my office and back. But that does mean some things, too, that apply to one's self-image. It means I come in all sweaty. I have to go from my office to a shower down the hall,
yeah,
and change. I do all kinds of odd things that few people would associate, certainly not my colleagues in the Brooks Brothers suits, with a Harvard professor. Well, hell with that. You define yourself, and you enjoy your freedom. So there is a trade-off there.
Right.
And if you do, again, have reinforcement from people that you do admire, who do similar things and are okay, that helps.
Sure does.
So we're an underground movement, perhaps, we freaks on bikes.
There was once at a Holden discussion like this, a new industry somewhere, and I wish I had written it down, when they built the factory, or it was small, but when they built bike racks as well as parking lot, locker rooms and showers, and encouraged riding your bike to work, and made the facilities for all those bike riders to take that shower before they worked, so that it was not odd. It was part of a larger portion of the people who worked there. Those are steps we need. Yes, right here.
One of the things you mentioned was economics.
Okay.
You're talking about a bicycle. You're saving a car.
Yeah.
That you're going to drive downtown, maybe an hour, 2 hours worth of driving, in my case, 20 minutes. To park for 8 hours, account the depreciation, the monthly cost, makes absolute no sense compared with the 35-cent bus ride. Your insurance company, if you do not use the car for your primary source of transportation,
right,
discount your insurance rate. That's economic. That is
right.
Even, it just makes good sense.
Right, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, like you said in the beginning, though, when you talked about where our housing is, everything would be built for this at all.
I know.
It's built for car transportation, so we can talk about bikes as small as we want.
Do you see where a session like this would go if we had a whole weekend retreat? You'd then be into the necessity for the political action needed for mass transportation, bike trails, and not only cultural things, but even laws and city planning for your city. That's right. So we're taking one little piece, and if you start down that, you'll find that you're part of an advocacy movement for bicycle riders and other things. Sure, that's right. One of the things that Sharon said seems to me, I don't want to drop it without picking it up at least once more. One of our cultural assumptions is to do it alone or to not seek advice. Another cultural assumption is where we go for advice when we do, and we have a really tragic situation in that the elders of our tribes are not respected. And if you want teachers on what we're doing, look to those people in this culture. Let me give you one more story. One of the finest weekends I ever, it wasn't a weekend, it was 2 days in the middle of the week. One of the finest retreats I ever had was at the place called the Cedars, which is Lutheran Outdoor Ministry of Oregon, outside of Portland, a beautiful retreat center. There was a center in Portland, and I don't like any of the names. I think it was called a senior center. You know, they always try to find a way to say that you have to be of a certain age, but they don't want to put you down, so that they, senior center or XYZ club, or I don't know what they called it, all right, was not a Christian group. I mean, it was not sponsored by a religious group. It was a city-funded center. But they said they wanted a retreat, and the planners of the retreat asked me to come down and do some sessions. And the thing I was really doing at that point, most of the time, was lifestyle issues, and I thought, well, why not? I tell you that I have some stereotypes. I imagine you do too. I thought if the first and the planners of the group decided the program, I thought they gave me an hour at 1:30 after a lunch, and there wasn't anyone under 70, and they were as old as 90. I thought, boy, if I'm going to have a time when they're going to be zonking on me, this is going to be it. They were absolutely alive. I couldn't believe it. I took some of the material from Enough is Enough. I took the Club of Rome report called Mankind at the Turning Point with some of the things that brought out. For an hour, we had give and take, but I gave a fairly substantive kind of lecture. When it was over, I found out why they were so alive. One person ventured, after we had had this hour, said, "Do you know, this is the first time we've had a program in the last 2 years where the assumption of the planners was that we still wanted to think?" And a little lady, she was at least 85, from the back of the room, bless her heart, spoke up, said, "Yes, you didn't pull up in a bus and show us another damn lake." And what broke through to me in a touching way was, they said, "You know, we've had twice in our life, we've had lifestyle changes, not of our choosing. We went through a depression, and we've all gone through our own retirement, and we did pretty well both times. and nobody ever asks. Nobody ever asks what we learned from those two experiences. There are some resources for lifestyle changes. I said the other day, it isn't that we don't have the books. Just go to the corner of the Holden bookstore. 99 Ways to Simplify Your Life, or How to Get Out of the Rat Race, or Covenant Group for Lifestyle Assessment, or Following Christ in a Consumer Society, Enough is Enough, Cheerful Revolution, of all kinds of ideas. It's when we have a vision of what that simplified or more freeing lifestyle would be and are willing to listen or to learn. There are all kinds of things that we can move, and there are people with whom you can link up. But it is a kind of lonely thing, and maybe especially, Paul, if you think it's hard being a bicycle rider at Harvard, I think it's even tougher to be the only kid in a high school or a junior high where your family is in on simplifying your lifestyle. And you're stuck with wanting to conform to the other kids, and you come from this family where, you know, like Charlie Brown's lunch, it just doesn't shape up to what the other kids have. Okay? I would be glad to hear. I mean, it is a valid question. I'm not facing it right now like Mary and I did once. Are there people facing what's it like to have high school and junior high kids and really wanting to make some changes but feeling their resistance? And
what coming to you as one in old people's home to ask you.
What? I'll give you two things first. And no, there is one. Go ahead.
Most important part of it for them to understand the reasons.
Okay.
If they are part of that process,
right.
They understand it and they enthusiastically join us, but we can't put anything on top of them. That's not responsible, not positive.
We arrived at them. Is Karen still here? She's no, all right. We arrived at them through consensus that included the kids. And that really it really respected them as fully part of the Schramm family in the moves we made and the things we did. And I think that's really important, and talked it through. Then there are also ways in which you can find the resources that kind of appeal to kids. The changes in food did not come easily. And kind of sermons about nutrition did not help. But Michael Jacobson's nutrition scoreboard did, because our kids, like most kids, wanted to see who won, because they like to see charts as to what. So they saw that they started with fruit. Well, you know what the most nutritious food is? By far, way up there. If you're from Wenatchee, you'll be disappointed. It is not apples. No, cantaloupe and watermelon. Oh my, well, they love both of them. Then they got to the cereals, and Michael Jacobson put Captain Crunch high above granola, and they thought, man, this guy may be, they assumed everything your parents said was good for you would be at the top, and everything they liked would be at the bottom. That wasn't the case. When they saw the chart, and then looked at the way we were eating, they started to take a new interest in it. Okay, secondly, that would be one. They were included in it. Secondly, we did try in our family relationships, in the parties we had, and the people that were around us that also had kids, to have a support base for them too in other kids who were living that way. And that's sometimes hard to do where you live. I mean, we did an easier thing than it would have been to stay in some neighborhoods. We moved to a county in West Virginia where the median income for a family of four in the 72, I guess, when we moved there, was $3,500 a year. So that all of their culture was the kind of simple life people of West Virginia. So I'm not sure I'm the old timer who can tell you how to do that. But that's a legitimate one for a legitimate question. It is 5 of 8. We obviously just got to start. It's obviously a subject that I'm interested in and would be happy if we had a little more time. I hope you got some ideas. You certainly have more resources available, including in the Holden bookstore. Let me finish with one story that kind of continues to remind me of lifestyle changes that start with a note of freedom. There was a couple driving late at night. They hadn't seen a motel for a long time. They were in a rural area, and they knew that it looked bad. It looked like they were going to sleep in the car, and they were really tired. So they did something that they don't often do. They saw lights on in a farmhouse and they decided, we're just going to ask if we can stay with strangers, total strangers. They went up to the door, didn't know what to expect. They went up to the door, man answered the door. They didn't know they had the local Mennonite farmer, good-natured Mennonite farmer. And they said, sir, we are travelers. It's late at night. We're sleepy. I don't think there's a motel. Is it possible that we could ask for your hospitality and stay here tonight? He said, absolutely. We're delighted to have you. I tell you what you do. You go out to the barn. I have fresh hay in the loft. You just go up there and you'll sleep well. You're welcome to just push the hay around. And if there's anything you need, anything at all, you come to the house and we'll tell you how you can get along without it for one night.